Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, everyone, welcome back to Gen Z. We are here again. We have an amazing guest coming. We'll tell you about that soon. But first, a quick little check-in. Avery, how are you? How's it going? Happy Thursday, which is when we're recording this.
Happy Thursday, everybody. I am doing great. Sam, as you know, got a wonderful little flurry of activity, fun things happening, like going to Canada for our first year of VaynerMedia Canada anniversary. Fired up for today's guest. She's one that we've been seeking to get on the pod for quite some time and has this incredible history of both agency side, luxury brand side, beauty side of helping brands pioneer new innovative formats of technology and consumer engagement. So fired up for her and fired up to see your lovely face as always.
I appreciate that. I will say our guest is Dina Fierro. She's an SVP at Shiseido Americas, really focusing on innovation across Web3, metaverse, blockchain, all that kind of stuff. And I will say that between you and her, you are both sort of two of my go-tos when I'm like, is this crazy? What am I thinking about? I need someone to put this in context. Both of you are sort of confidants, and I really appreciate always getting the opportunity to speak with you and speak with her. And I'm glad that our listeners get to spend a little bit of time with Dina, because she really is such a smart and well-spoken ambassador for innovation. But first, Avery, we have a couple stories to go through. I think the biggest one, which, you know, we need to talk about, is the sunsetting of the Starbucks Odyssey program. You know, we had Adam and Andy on the show, I'm going to say about a year ago, telling us about the program. Adam was the chief digital officer at Starbucks, was very bullish, what it seemed, in the digital collectible yep. space. And that seemed to fade relatively quickly. And I will also say, it didn't seem to, it didn't escape me that when the shift in Forum 3, their company, that when they started to shift to focus on AI, it felt like we just stopped hearing about Odyssey, which also I think was an interesting tell. But I guess I want to first just get your thoughts on the fact that of the experiment that Starbucks ran, and then let's break it down a little bit for the audience.
Yeah, so I'm going to actually side with Starbucks on this one, which I know we're going to have different perspectives here. And, you know, I think that Starbucks themselves did not overly communicate about Odyssey, right? They always framed it as a beta. It was always a separate experience. It was not sort of an in-house owned technology. It was a collaboration that they were doing with Nifty Gateway and with Forum 3. And I'm not exactly sure how that deal was structured, but maybe it was some type of a JV or something like that. Forum 3 spoke about Odyssey a lot. And, you know, Adam joined our podcast, which was amazing. And he is a really seasoned executive who, I would say, similar to us, sort of fell into like really believing in this digital first future because it makes so much sense logically. And he combined that with his relationship graph and his former employer and, you know, built an interesting team that included some like really Web3 native people, which I think at that time, that was totally the right thing to do. And, you know, as Starbucks Odyssey launched, there was a lot of hype. There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of these, you know, journey stamps selling for a lot of money. I also noticed that the video that you had to watch to get their training stamps was actually an employee training video. So I think they were repurposing certain parts of, you know, the collateral and whatnot that they had as Starbucks as part of this beta. I will clarify that Vayner has never had any relationship with Starbucks on anything related to Web3. So this is purely from a consumer POV. This was my take from what I observed. And, you know, I noticed that even like the emails and things like that were not formatted in the same way that the rest of the Starbucks communication was, which is fine. And they always framed it as a beta. There was no promises. They were very clearly not communicating anything about like financial speculation. Yet I would often see members of their team celebrating like financial, you know, high sales and things like that. And when I say their team, I don't mean the Starbucks team, because it was never like there were never Starbucks employees like community managing or anything like that. It was almost like that was coming, you know, from a separate partner. And a lot of the communication and interviews and press and podcasts and whatnot also came not directly from Starbucks. Though I believe the CEO did mention Odyssey on their earnings call, which was a big moment. So all that to say is that was the right thing to do at the time. I think in April of 2024, it's a different time. And if I'm, you know, I've had this conversation with plenty of our brand partners who have evolved their strategy as it relates to Web3, right? And I think the reading the tea leaves for any Fortune 500 brand is there might have been almost a false start for like the excitement and the energy and the consumer engagement that was happening in this in 2021, 22, that like those numbers just are not, everyone was sort of anticipating this might really grow. And it's doing the opposite of growing in a lot of these cases. And for them, you know, there needs to be scale in order for there to be business impact. And, you know, I think that it sort of makes sense. I'm sure they objectively evaluated, is this a place that we want to continue investing our time, our money, our brand in 2024 beyond the beta? And they've clearly come to the decision that not for now. You know, there was an email that went out to all Odyssey folks, of which I am one, that was just super like nice. Hey, you know, FYI, this journey is coming to a conclusion. You know, here's what you do with your remaining journey stamps, et cetera. And they said they're going to give everyone like a parting gift, which I thought was nice. So I actually am Team Starbucks on this. I know a lot of people are, especially those who are deep in the Web3 community, are, I can't believe they're doing this. They're backing away from Web3. I don't think that's the case. I think they're running their business and they're prioritizing their marketing initiatives, and they need to do the right thing for today for their business. While I'm sure they'll be keeping an eye on what's happening in the space and can, of course, re-engage these consumers at a later date. So that's my take.
I appreciate that. And I actually don't probably disagree as much as you think I would. I think this was not the right program for Starbucks. And I don't think it was ever the right program for Starbucks. I think the way you describe it accurately is akin to more like a licensing deal than an actual sort of in-house program that they truly wanted to develop themselves. One of my colleagues made an analysis, which I think went up today or on our YouTube channel, about how you never could see anything about Odyssey in any store, right? So the ability to even promote this was never really brought into the true core Starbucks experience. I remember we had a very early call, I think you were on as well, with Adam when he was telling some friends about the program itself. And one of the things that seemed very interesting to me was the idea that they have 5,000 plus locations that could be an amazing way to utilize those for community opportunities, for unlocks of special performances or special tastings or whatever it may be. And just none of that ever came to fruition because I think they always thought of it as something that was very small and siloed. They have the biggest and the most successful loyalty program in the world. So it makes sense you don't want to change that if it's not broken, because it clearly is not. But I do think that you don't want it to be only something that exists on this fringe. And I think that is the reason to shut it down, because I don't think they were ready to invest in it in a more full and meaningful way. I also think, you know, and this was reported by us and others, but, you know, they received a substantial offset investment from Polygon for this project. And so when you have Nifty Gateway and you have Polygon throwing you a couple million dollars and you're going to write funding and you're going to make some money on the stamp sales, which they know they were, and they loved the idea, I remember, of working with different artists in the same way people collect Starbucks cups. So it kind of all made sense, but I kind of feel like it was a dip your toe in, not dip your whole body in and see what's going to happen.
But they framed it as such.
No, of course. But I guess what I'm saying is I think that in some respects, from even the rollout, we could probably see the writing on the wall that this wasn't going to work in this manner, which is okay. But it is one of those things where I think the Web3 community, which is still small but very vocal and often to each other, I think they're the ones who are taking, you know, it really negatively that, oh, look, this big brand, because frankly, in every deck any of us saw for a year, Starbucks, Nike were the brands they were talking about. Look, the big ones are all coming. And I think the reality is it's not going to be that way. I think the brands that are going to succeed out of Web3 are probably going to succeed natively out of Web3 and break into traditional culture. And I don't know if we've even seen the beginnings of that one yet. I don't think it was a surprise. I do think it puts the spotlight a little bit on Nike to say, hey, what are y'all doing? Because there was a bunch of speculation last week whether Nike was going to be the next one. Their Twitter presence would let you think, nope, we're still going with Swoosh. But I think there's a lot of people thinking about that. There was also a rumor that Nike was sort of defunding the Artifact brand, which they bought for supposedly a bucket of money in 2021. And, you know, I think the Web3 audience is starting to say, hey, maybe the brands aren't coming the way we thought, and maybe their path to mass adoption is not going to be through big brands, which I think is a great sort of lead up to what our guest today will be talking about. But yeah, I'm feeling a little bit like not super surprised, not frankly super sad. I never thought their experience was great. I thought it was like, hey, to get a stamp, I have to watch this training video. I have to like visit 19 stores and I have to take a quiz about, you know, my Christmas flavors. Wasn't really core Web3. It felt a little overly marketing.
Yeah, for sure. But it was a beta, and you know, I also want to sort of stand up for agency partners in these situations, because I think a lot of, you know, at the end of the day, like as an agency, you're representing a brand, but that doesn't mean it's your program. Like when we do a campaign, like sure, we might have come up with the idea and wrote the script and came up with it, but ultimately, like the brand is the one signing off on, you know, yes, this is approved, this isn't, I insist you hold it like this, you know, we have to shoot it in this location, whatever it is, we have to use this Nifty Gateway, or we have to get it funded. And I think that sometimes people get that, and our listeners, I think this is interesting context for them. A lot of times people will just associate like the agency partner, in this case, like the Forum 3, with coming up with the whole thing. And while I'm sure they had an extremely active like leadership role in concepting it and building it out, at the end of the day, the decision to, you know, to keep it or to not does fall with the brand. And I've seen a little bit of like people sort of getting confused in that concept in a lot of these sort of like Web3 native agencies that sprung up and launched programs like, this is your project. And, you know, putting on my CMO hat and my marketer hat, I'm like, not really. It's ultimately the brand's project. And even from like a rights perspective, like they own all of that stuff, not the agency. Right. So this say lobby is my POV. And I'm not holding my breath for Nike in this one, but let's see how it all shakes out.
Yeah, my final thought on this also is, even if you look at the sort of timeline of mixed reality, right? Like we're now at the Apple Vision Pro stage of mixed reality, and it still feels like a developer device. Mm-hmm. Before that, we had the Quest. Before that, we had the Oculus. Before that, we had Google Glass. Everything was like iterative to get us to the next thing. And now that journey already has been 10 plus years. So I think that one can look at the Starbucks example or the Nike example or any of these other brands coming in to say, we need actually all of these things to happen. But we should not get wedded to the timeline needing to be now 6 months from now next year, because this really, the digital collectible conversation, which we're going to get into in a second, is really a 10, 20 year change in culture. It's not something that's going to happen overnight. I think a lot back to when I was in high school working at sneaker stores and seeing the first Jordans and the first, you know, kind of big sneakers coming out. And like, no one cared about collecting them. Everyone just thought they were overpriced.
Right.
And yet if you had, you know, if I'd bought every new pair that came out when I was working at that store, I'd be able to retire now. Right. So it took 15 years even for sneaker culture to recognize these things had value that was beyond just the value of wearing them on your feet. And so that's like, okay, do I think this stuff takes a long time? Avery, I have one quick question before we get to our next guest, which is, have you bought any meme coins in the last week? Because almost everyone else I know has.
I might have dabbled. I think I'm still a little hungover from the NFT days, but I'm playing around. How about you, Sam? How deep are you?
I have one.
Okay. Only one?
It was just a friend. Only one, because a friend of ours is the community manager of it.
Great.
And I only won because I honestly feel like I don't have the time nor the patience to like play to the 15-second or 15-minute increments about whether I'm going to make a lot of money or lose everything, which it feels like the meme coin craze is. But I say that because I keep thinking that all of this stuff around meme coins and the frenzy and the things getting crazy amounts of value so quickly is yet another reason that the masses and the large brands are going to stay away. It's the idea of over-financialization of culture and the, you know, that this myth that I think the crypto audience has, that just because we use a meme in a tweet as a response, or we're trolling somebody, or we're putting it as part of a reaction emoji, that has intrinsic value that's going to be worth tons and tons of money in the future. It feels like, for me, a missed alignment of what even meme culture is, which really is a language that everybody can play with each other and have fun, and you get the gamification. But once you add too much value, I think it sort of makes the meme feel a little dirty. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, yes, that culture can be financialized, where, again, whether it's hip hop or sneakers or, you know, an Hermes product, but I don't think you can force it through the idea of fractional ownership of said culture, especially when it lives on the internet.
Absolutely. I mean, the over-financialization of everything is just a perfect way to put it. Meme coins are like going to the casino. Like, you can have fun and you can have a great night in Vegas, or you can have not a great night in Vegas. And I think people trying to like read into it too much often like sort of overcomplicate it, because right now, like, there's not necessarily a rhyme or reason. Everyone's launching a meme coin and, like, you know, figuring this out. And a lot of people are making a lot of money. I don't know if this will need to be scrubbed out, but one friend of mine who's in one of my group chats was sharing a story. He told us to, like, look into this coin, and who knows who's free to do it. As you know, my work schedule, I'm pretty much work from like 8 to 8. So I like don't have like responsive time during those hours. Within a few hours, he turned $18,000 into $1.2 million. And I was like, oh my God. But it's a full-time job. And for every one of those, there's 99 people who the opposite happened. So
yes,
it is just sort of funny to hear those stories. You hear people going off on Twitter and doing spaces. There's, you know, meme NFTs now selling for millions of dollars again. So 'tis the season. And, you know, some of my normal friends who are not into crypto are like, what coin should I get? I'm like, yep, it's back. Nature is healing.
Yes.
And don't ask me, because I do not have financial advice.
Same. I will not give you anything. Yes. One of my friends who has not been working for the last month said that they made their entire salary in the last month on meme coins. And then, of course, I said, well, did you sell? And they were like, oh, no, I haven't done that yet. So that, of course, when I was like, uh-oh, you know, get out, get taxes paid and make it happen. All right. We are going to get to our guest, Dina Fierro, SVP at Shiseido. One caveat, this interview was recorded yesterday. Avery and I were in both in very different locations. So you will notice that in the video, but we will come back to recap it together, and we will see you guys after the break.
Can't wait.
Consensus 2024. Global crypto regulation, the disruptive power of AI, the rise of tokenization. Consensus is the one event where experts convene to talk about the ideas shaping our digital future. Join developers, investors, founders, brands, policymakers, and plenty more in Austin, Texas from May 29th through the 31st. The 10th annual Consensus is curated by CoinDesk to feature the industry's most sought-after speakers and provide unparalleled networking opportunities and unforgettable experiences. Take 15% off registration with the code GENC15. Register now at consensus.coindesk.com, and I'll see you there. Welcome back, everybody. We have an amazing guest with us today, Dina Fierro. Dina is SVP Web3 Metaverse at Shiseido America, and we're very excited to have her. Dina is a long-time innovator, marketer, big thinker when it comes to how brands should be utilizing these new technologies. So super excited to have you here. Dina, for our audience, in 60 seconds, tell us about your background.
60 seconds. Okay, that's very efficient.
All right, I'll give you 120.
Okay, really thoughtful. So first of all, thank you, Sam and Avery, for having me. Longtime listener of Gen Z, so it's exciting to be a guest as well. In terms of my life story, I would say that I went to fashion school, actually here in New York at FIT, with the intention of becoming a buyer. So perhaps an unexpected origin story for someone who now works in emergent technology. I very quickly discovered that being a buyer was not going to be nearly as glamorous as I had anticipated. So I had pictured, you know, sort of sitting front row at Fashion Week in Paris and, you know, maybe buying on behalf of Bergdorf Goodman. And the reality of buying is that you're actually sitting in front of a computer, kind of like I am now, only you are doing complicated retail math in an Excel document. And so very quickly, I realized that that was not necessarily the you know, course that I wanted to chart for my career. And so I first kind of fell into a little bit of editorial and styling, and then quickly moved more into PR and marketing because that offered me a little more stability in those early days of my career. And right around the same time is when I would say that really the blogosphere and online communities were beginning to emerge. And I became personally very invested in some really interesting online fashion communities in particular that were forming at that time. In fact, I was just thinking about this yesterday in preparation for our conversation today. And I'm actually still a member to this day of a Facebook group that actually originated more than 15 years ago as an online forum. And I'm still, you know, sort of friends online and in the real world with a lot of those women that I met because of our shared passions and interests. So as I mentioned, around the same time I started my blog, which was called Eye for Style. If my memory serves, I started my blog in 2006. So it would be 18 years old now. It would be graduating high school. Having a blog afforded me a lot of, you know, sort of the privileges that influencers and creators have today. You know, I was able to attend Fashion Week. I was backstage interviewing hairstylists and makeup artists, posting long form content to YouTube. I was appearing in brand campaigns and doing sponsored content. But at the same time, I knew that it wasn't necessarily sort of the path that I wanted to pursue in terms of my full-time career. It was more of an area of, you know, creative exploration for me. So I had still continued to work sort of in PR and marketing at the time. And I wound up taking a role at a small social media marketing agency in New York called Attention. And that was really a pivotal turning point in my career because at Attention, I wound up working really, really closely with a lot of incredibly interesting brands in the fashion and beauty space and launching many of those brands actually in social media and introducing them to, for example, concepts around influencer marketing, you know, sort of content and editorial, the importance of online communities, social shopping and live streaming. So it was a really, really formative time in my career. I spent around 9 or 10 years working agency side before I took another sort of turn. And I went in-house at Christian Louboutin, working in a role in which I oversaw sort of digital touch points globally for the brand. So that encompassed not only editorial and social media and content, but also influencer marketing and, you know, got to work really closely with our teams on things like eventing and sort of large scale sponsorships and events. So that was also a really interesting opportunity to kind of, you know, work, I would say, on a more global scale and to get a different perspective. And then in 2018, I joined NARS first as a consultant and then came on board full time in 2019 as the VP overseeing digital globally. And so at NARS, I was able to lean in further, I would say, in a lot of these emergent spaces that we're here to talk about today. So, you know, I led a lot of our brand's earliest forays into, for example, gaming, the metaverse, and Web3. And because of the success of a lot of those pilot projects in my 5 years at the brand, I stepped into a more transversal role in January of 2019 within Shiseido Americas. And so I now work across our portfolio of brands on, you know, projects that, again, touch those emergent spaces. Was that 120 seconds?
It was longer, but it was amazing. It had some incredible vocabulary words. So Dina, you know, it seems like you have been early to many things in your career, from starting on social to digital touch points, to linking to eventing, to now, of course, Web3 and metaverse. Has that been a personal passion point for you? Do you think it's in this sort of business opportunity, a little bit of both? Can you talk us through sort of how that through line has played out across your career?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that that has always been an area of interest for me. I think, you know, personally speaking, I've always been really interested in emergent spaces and culture. And I find it really fascinating to think about new, compelling, and often unexpected ways in which we can cut through the clutter and reach and engage people or consumers on behalf of brands. So that's definitely been something that I've done a lot of experimentation with since my very earliest days, I would say agency side. I think you could also chalk it up to a degree, maybe, to, you know, a short attention span. Like a lot of the spaces that we talk about now, like influencer marketing and social media, I think in part because I was working in those spaces since the very origin, working in more emergent areas of tech, in more emergent platforms, it just provides us an opportunity to expand upon sort of those skill sets.
So you get bored, but you use it to your advantage career-wise.
And hopefully to the advantage of our brands as well.
Dina, not to be low vibrational, but do we think that brands in general get bored with some of these platforms too quickly?
I want to dig a little deeper on the question and ask sort of what platforms you're thinking of when you ask the question.
Well, I feel like as someone who I do think tries a ton in a lot of different platforms, mm-hmm. you probably are tracking how much both your brands and some others are dabbling,
sure.
if you will.
Yep.
You know, we just saw this week, and it certainly was not a dabble, but we just saw the announcement that Starbucks was, you know, sunsetting its loyalty program. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of critiques, I think, that unless you put the whole program on chain, that you're always creating something that feels a little bit like a side project. You and I, when we were in South By, we also talked a lot about Farcaster and some of these other platforms. And there's been a million that have been out that sort of people get excited about, starting, you know, the Second Life days all the way mm-hmm. to now. And so I think when you think about the mix of like traditional social, where social is gone, all these emergent exploratory platforms, how do you think brands need to think about evolving their brand marketing when, you know, if you make a big bet on Decentraland, you might not get audience. If you make a big bet on Roblox, it might be a very crowded space. You know, how do you kind of play that mix well?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. And there are so many different directions to take the answer. I will say, you know, and this is a little annoying, I'm sure, but the reality is that every brand is different. So dependent on the brand's identity, the brand's DNA, their consumer target, their goals, their budget, their strategy and tactics are all going to differ. You know, that said, I do think that there are critical channels for every brand in 2024, at least, you know, assuming that those brands are looking to sort of build against those traditional consumer objectives of awareness, consideration, and conversion. So for me, you know, it's kind of a given that any brand is going to be investing in social, building and nurturing community, and also presumably investing to some degree in influencer and or creator marketing. That said, I think that the more emergent or the more niche platforms, you know, that's a little bit of a different story. For me, you know, on behalf of our brands at Shiseido Americas, I really do assess through a lens that is both qualitative and also quantitative. So in order for a platform to be worthy of investment for our brands, there does need to be, I would say, a degree of scale, or at minimum, what I would consider to be critical momentum. That's something that I talk about quite a bit. The demographics also have to align to a degree with the consumer that we're targeting. And, you know, I work for a group of prestige beauty brands that is largely a female audience that we're targeting, and a prestige female audience. So we need to be thoughtful that the platforms in which we're engaging kind of, you know, mirror those demographics to a degree. And then they also need to be brand safe environments. And that's where I think, in particular, when we look at spaces like Web3, there is a degree of risk involved in all Web3 programming that, you know, we've seen from consumer brands. And, you know, some brands have had really strong risk mitigation plans to sort of head off any of those issues. And then we've seen other brands kind of suffer the consequences from the community and then seeing that play out as well in the press. So, you know, I think in general, we try and be very thoughtful and place the majority of our investment, our effort and our resources into platforms that are tried and true that we know are going to deliver upon our business objectives. But then we always reserve a degree, you know, of budget to test and learn in new environments. And that isn't, by the way, just in spaces like Web3 or the metaverse, you know, that even bleeds through into our broader media strategy. So when I think about, for example, the different spaces in which our brands have played over perhaps the past 5 years, you know, we were testing in environments like streaming or audio or AR-enabled display media very early. So we were able to kind of take learnings from those early tests and then scale that out across our portfolio of brands as appropriate. So, you know, innovation doesn't just, it's not just limited to these spaces. I think it really is a mindset that needs to move through the entire organization across different disciplines.
I love that you just talked about both the budget component and the mindset component, because I think there's that sort of traditional 80-20, 90-10 framing of, hey, we need to do what we know works, but we also need to be open to like, what's that next thing? Because who knows, Decentraland, it could end up being a ghost town or it could end up being the next big thing, right? You sort of have to participate to a degree to find out, because sometimes when there's that early momentum, it might seem like it could turn into a big thing. And sometimes that's the next TikTok and sometimes that's the next Decentraland, right? And you have to be participating.
Right.
But I also like what you talked about mindset. And I think that's something that you do really well, Dina. Can you, you know, explain sort of how you help bring that mindset of innovation across your portfolio of brands?
You know, it is interesting because I think that education and enthusiasm go a long way. And so a lot of what I do in my role is actually around education, exposure, and participation. So while I lead sort of this centralized acceleration team, like a lot of other, you know, people that you've interviewed over the course of the past several months, we do work on our projects in a very collaborative way with all of the respective stakeholders on our brands. And I think that their active participation in a lot of these projects just serves to raise the digital IQ of the organization. And when they are part of a successful project, it also makes, you know, sort of the buy-in on future projects that might be, you know, again, in more emergent spaces, it makes that conversation much easier because you've essentially built the trust with the brand. So that's something that I definitely spend a lot of my time doing. I mean, we do it in many different ways. Myself and my team, we do a weekly newsletter. We'll do founder firesides internally. We do regional education sessions that are open to the entire organization, whether those are marketing stakeholders or supply chain. So all of those have been really well received, and they help us sort of further our mission around innovation.
You know, to switch to some of the projects you've executed, you know, I think about the average NFT investor seeing that there was an opportunity to buy an NFT that brought with it an orgasm. And the conversation around such that ensued afterwards online was interesting, but not recognizing that orgasm is the name of a line within NARS, and you've been promoting it for years and years. It's one of your best-selling products.
Iconic.
It is iconic. And I do think that that was, you know, kind of a bold choice to do, because I think you probably knew that the digital collectible world was going to have that reaction. And, you know, those things make great headlines and make great conversation. But you've done everything from launching NFTs for the Orgasm line to the most recent project you launched at Art Basel this year with Art Blocks Engine and utilizing generative art. You had done some early NFT stuff. Remember, I still have one somewhere with some other amazing artists. And so I guess, like, just what are your thoughts generally on sort of NFTs, digital collectibles, the current kind of on-chain macro of, you know, people having these digital assets in their wallets?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a big question in there. And I would say that fundamentally, you know, I still very much believe in the value proposition of digital collectibles, in particular digital art. And, you know, one of the projects that you mentioned, the Shiseido Future Reflections launch, which was created in collaboration with Art Blocks Engine and four incredible generative artists, that was probably my favorite project that we launched in 2023. I thought part of what made that project so special is that it was actually so closely aligned to the DNA of the Shiseido organization. And it was also really aligned to exactly how the organization approaches beauty product innovation. So innovation in formula, for example, in packaging, which is a space where, you know, Shiseido is 152 years old. We hold thousands of patents. So innovation central to the identity, and creating beauty products in particular, is a perfect merging of art, science, and technology, just as generative art is a perfect merging of art, science, and technology. So for me, it was really finding sort of, you know, that point of connection to the brand, our heritage, and our, you know, DNA that made that project so powerful. You know, that said, I think when I look at projects upcoming for 2024, or when I think ahead to the upcoming years, we are probably more focused on sort of longer term use cases of blockchain and collectibles. You know, despite the folding of Starbucks Odyssey program, I do still think that digital tokens and collectibles offer a powerful point of connection for brands and their consumers. And so still very interested in digging into sort of that tokenized community and or loyalty space. We have also, I mean, recently in EMEA, you know, we've been working on projects that sort of leverage digital product passports. And I think that's something that we've seen, you know, a lot of exploration in within the luxury space. And it, you know, makes such tremendous sense when we think about luxury goods. It also makes sense when we think about, you know, sort of the provenance of beauty products, where, you know, gray market, for example, is a problem that we need to combat. And I think one of the really interesting things about whether it's Web3 technology or other tech is really considering it through the lens of, you know, what organizational challenges can it help us solve? What consumer pain points can it help us solve? Rather than thinking about, for example, an NFT or a blockchain project, you know, purely through the lens of novelty or driving awareness.
It's so interesting to hear you sort of, one, share your continued conviction around blockchain, around digital collectibles, and around the use cases, both from a sort of consumer side and also from a supply chain side. That's the second time you've mentioned this on this podcast. So I think it's percolating at the top of your mind. I'm curious what Shiseido is cooking up there. But I'm curious also how you all are sort of balancing the blockchain side of your job with what you're doing in the world of gaming and of metaverse. Is that, you know, sort of a place where you're continuing to expand and to pursue projects and initiatives?
For sure. You know, I think that gaming and sort of more immersive platforms like Roblox, those are the platforms that really offer us scale. You know, when we think about sort of bringing new audiences to the brands and or engaging existing audiences, you know, who are interested in beauty. And so, you know, our forays into gaming actually began, you know, sort of before I was even part of the brand. NARS was one of the earliest brands to integrate into the Kim Kardashian mobile game, which actually just folded. Really kind of sad. It was actually one of the first mobile games targeting women.
And also but, first and most successful, by the way. Like, you know, you can say whatever you want about Kim, but Kim knows how to do business. And that, I mean, I think we did some integrations there as well. So that's a blast from the past, but that was a very successful pioneering app.
It absolutely was. It saw super strong engagement. But just to come back to your question, I would say that we have learned a lot from our experiments in gaming, and they have been to date enormously successful. So for NARS, we activated, for example, in 2021 on both Dressed, which is a luxury styling game based in the UK. And we also brought the brand onto Zepeto, which is, you know, a Korean-based metaverse app. So we had sort of mini experiences within Zepeto. And then we also brought a collection of NARS virtual artistry looks and virtual goods into the store within Zepeto. And I will say that that activation in particular was really what solidified for me the virtual goods opportunity, even within the beauty space. So, you know, we all talk a lot about digital collectibles and virtual fashion. I think working in this space, and it continues to be something I'm super interested in. But within Zepeto, for example, we were really using that project as a mechanism to drive awareness around a new launch, to, you know, drive engagement and to generate user-generated content that would kind of bleed through to other social platforms. But what we saw instead, or in addition, I should say, is that users on that platform are incredibly engaged in avatar customization. And so the artistry looks and virtual goods that we offered were really well received. We actually sold within Zepeto, I think it was approaching 800,000 virtual goods. So pretty compelling. Roblox, you know, similarly, that is a platform that we have been very successful on. We were one of the earliest beauty brands, and I say we meaning NARS, was one of the earliest beauty brands to activate on Roblox in 2022 with the NARS ColorQuest experience. That experience remains one of the most successful branded experiences to date on platform, despite the fact that it was only live for 90 days. We saw well over 40 million visits. And similarly, I think what makes spaces like Roblox so compelling is the engagement that you see. So, you know, that's a word that I've used a lot. But when we look, for example, at average session length of a player or a participant on Roblox, that is easily on the low end, maybe 8 minutes of time spent. On the high end, 13, 14 minutes of time spent per session. You know, I think we've all worked in social or in digital to some degree. And when you compare that, for example, to the precious 3 or 6 seconds of time that you might capture through, let's say, paid media or through a piece of own content on Instagram, it's very easy to see how valuable that time is with each user on a platform like Roblox. So we continue to be super bullish.
6 seconds is rich these days. Honestly, it's like one swipe. It's one right. second. And that's actually a narrative that we've been talking a lot about recently within Vayner. It's not six anymore. It used to be three. It used to be five. It used to be six. Now it's one, just like speed of swiping, speed of thumb. So it's a really interesting contrast.
Yeah, it really is.
I also think, and Dean, I mean, you are... if I remember, one of the also first beauty brands to go on TikTok. I mean, I do think you
2019.
You keep pushing, I think, the exploration of finding out where intersection can be. And, you know, and I remember you and I talking after that TikTok project, because I think because you were early, because you knew and worked within the program, you know, you saw an exponential opportunity for people to, you know, get involved and then become part of the UGC element of what was going on there. And then even what you're saying now, you know, we've spoken to now a number of brands who have built, you know, Fortnite worlds or Roblox, and very consistently it's, you know, hey, yeah, from 8 to 14 minutes, 6 to 40 million people, you know, and at a cost that is roughly the same as building a high-end event for 200 influencers in Paris.
Sure.
You know, and so even though, you know, if you look at influencer events as trying to get reach, you're probably at a comparable, if not greater reach, in some of these game worlds, because there is that curiosity, with the exception that you might be getting an audience that still skews younger.
Sure.
But as we, when we were talking to Pia from BMW, she was like, it skews younger, but those people are going to drive cars at some point. So why not give them a fun way to think about our brand
100%. Earlier? 100%. And I think that participation in gaming and immersive environments, it is also just a much richer and more memorable engagement with the brand. So, you know, I know that our time is limited, but even thinking about an experience like NAR's Color Quest, that entire experience from the environment to the NPCs to the features were all directly inspired sort of by the heritage, the DNA, the lore of the brand. So the founder of the brand, for example, appeared as an NPC within the experience. We had a first of its kind metaverse makeup editor that allowed you to create bespoke avatar looks, you know, not just sort of off the shelf artistry looks that had been created by our artistry directors. So it was really a very immersive experience and a very on brand experience. And just one other point, you know, you're talking a little bit about like the demographic on a platform like Roblox or like Fortnite. And the truth is, you know, that demographic though is aging up really, really quickly. And in fact, you know, Gen Z in particular is the fastest growing demographic on Roblox. And we talked a little bit earlier about demographics more broadly, including gender. And I think one of the other things that I find very compelling about Roblox is that it is almost a 50-50 split between male and female users. And that is highly unusual in a lot of gaming environments. And if anything, you know, I would say that female users are pretty dramatically underserved when we think about a lot of the big gaming publishers. And so it's really exciting kind of to find those pockets and platforms where they are engaged really actively.
Dibi, you just mentioned avatars and metaverse sort of advisors. It wouldn't be a 2024 podcast if we didn't ask you how you are starting to think about AI and, you know, particularly your perspective around these sort of AI avatars that I'm seeing everywhere now, both selling products on places like TikTok and, you know, showing up across social feeds. Of course, you know, creators are leveraging these themselves and sort of building these new personalities. How are you thinking about sort of virtual influencers and avatars from your vantage point?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question because, and you know, you may already be aware, Avery, but in 2022, we also launched on behalf of NARS 3 virtual ambassadors, the Power Players. So the Power Players were a pioneering trio. They are a pioneering trio of metahumans who were built in Unreal Engine 5. Again, very closely connected to the brand. Each avatar's identity is actually inspired directly by an iconic and best-selling shade of lip color. So in 2022, we introduced those avatars, primarily through a suite of social content. But the reality is that they were created actually to engage users in native immersive environments. So we weren't creating them, for example, to live on D2C necessarily or in social. We were creating them to live in environments, presumably like a Fortnite. And so we actually have reanimated the Power Players since their launch. In 2023, we did a pretty compelling activation at Sephora, which is Sephora's largest scale consumer activation of the year. It was hosted here in New York last September. So for Sephora, we brought the Power Players into a life-size metaverse portal, for lack of a better term, and consumers were able to engage directly with the avatar of their choosing to ultimately sort of find their, you know, dream shade of Power Matte Lip. And it was really, honestly, a very interesting project to work on for a number of reasons, as you can imagine. But I think one of the things that made it most interesting is that, you know, we started the pre-production on that project in maybe Q1 of 2023, when, you know, AI was really reaching sort of a new fervor after, you know, the launch of ChatGPT and all of the buzz surrounding ChatGPT. And we did have to make a decision in that moment as to whether we were going to pursue the path of having a real-time installation that leveraged motion capture actors or in leveraging AI, which brings an inherent degree of risk to it, even in this moment in 2024. And so to ensure an incredibly high touch experience and also to mitigate risk, we actually decided to move forward and have a motion capture artist embody the Power Players, which, by the way, that's also one of the very cool things about building an Unreal Engine 5 is that any of us, by the way, it doesn't even need to be a professional. Any of us could literally man those avatars from an app on our phone. And it looks incredibly realistic and it's incredibly real time. So that was the path that we pursued. That said, we have done some internal tests that leverage, for example, AI that imbue those avatars with personality and a voice. And it's definitely pretty interesting. But we do want to be cautious because I think both virtual influencers and also AI, there's mixed sentiment around them from consumers, particularly in the US and in EMEA. When we look at our Asian markets, in particular China or even Japan, where there are some very famous virtual influencers, including Emma, who's actually currently in a Coach campaign alongside Lil Nas X.
Oh, I'm very familiar with it.
So, you know, I think that we just want to be thoughtful about how and where we use those virtual influencers and ensure that they're actually sort of serving a purpose within the activation and that we're not just using them as a gimmick. So, you know, I think that's sort of one project that touches on avatars and AI. Obviously, you know, we use AI already as an organization. And there are also some, you know, really interesting products that are being built at HQ that leverage AI and perhaps allow for a more personalized, consumer experience. So we'll look forward to sharing more on that in the coming months.
You know, it's interesting that you just sort of mentioned Ema. Ema, just so our listeners on Gen Z know, actually is not necessarily like a new character. Like we did a campaign with Ema in 2018 for a skincare brand, actually. And now we're working, Ema is doing other sort of brand campaigns and she's back in her orbit. But it's interesting because there's this like resurgence of virtual influencers, the Lil Michaelas, the Emas, that I think is driven by this sort of new wave of AI. And I actually think it's such an interesting time for brands to, one, think about crafting their own avatars, whether that's Power Players or that's a specific individual or, you know, there's a lot of different ways to take it, mascots or creators who are looking, who maybe they have amazing content, amazing things to say, but maybe they don't have a face for radio. And this is a good way for them to actually build an audience and a following on these video platforms. So it's a really, we could probably do a whole podcast just on this.
I mean, I'm sure you could. I think in beauty in particular, there is an interesting friction there just because over the course of the past 5 to 10 years, every beauty brand has had to become much more comfortable with authenticity, to use another overused buzzword. But, you know, Sam, you mentioned earlier TikTok, and I remember what a huge, you know, mindset shift that required of brands, particularly beauty brands that are more accustomed to producing, you know, super polished content. So, you know, TikTok has required brands to become more comfortable with lo-fi content and also, you know, more comfortable in working with creators who aren't necessarily the creators they would have worked with in the past. Maybe they're creators that, you know, are sort of outside of their respective niche or vertical. You know, obviously TikTok is all about tapping into subcultures. That's sort of where a lot of the power lies. So I think, yeah, there is an interesting friction there in that, you know, we want to continue to see real people, real skin, authenticity, personality. But I think there is also a place for us to leverage synthetic personas in a way that sort of, you know, serves the brand and serves the consumer.
It's yes and. Like, yeah, yes, sure. Authenticity and leaning into technology and doing it in a way that builds the brand. But I think you've touched a few times on brand safety. And, like, there's a lot of minefields in AI, especially with beauty, right? Yeah. Like, even retouching is canceled. AI is a whole other kind of caboodle. So lots more to discuss on that in a future date.
I think about young Dina buying, like being a buyer for Bergdorf and someone saying, oh, you're going to have power player AI driven metahumans in a metaverse portal that will be life size in your future. And you're like what you would have thought back then.
Yeah. But Dina, you often spread the message of caution when it comes to sort of going too quickly into emerging tech, which I think is really refreshing given your leadership role in the Web3 and metaverse space. Do you think that that brands should be realistic, that some technologies are all not going to be right for them? Or do you think there's some merit in just tasting along the way, even if it's not necessarily, you know, demographically aligned?
I mean, look, I think that new technology, new platforms, they're incredibly exciting. And I also think that it can be really exciting to be a pioneer, and that can actually in many ways contribute to a brand's objectives, particularly if they're looking to tech and sort of emergent spaces as an opportunity to potentially shift brand perception or to acquire new audiences. But that said, I also think, especially, you know, in 2024, we need to be very thoughtful about where we're investing our time and energy. And so, you know, we touched on this a little bit earlier in our conversation, but we definitely do need to see a degree of adoption, for example, and a degree of momentum around new technology or platforms before we can consider them worthy of investment. You know, and I think the demographic piece is really critical. And frankly, this is even something that I've been thinking about as I test, you know, the Apple Vision Pro and have these really cool spatial experiences that I do think represent in many ways the future of digital experience and potentially the future of digital commerce. But the reality is that in this moment, that's still, for example, a very niche device. And I think it might be different if we had innovation budgets that, you know, were sort of the size of, let's say, our media budgets, then we could potentially play with more technology without expecting necessarily, you know, ROI from all of those pilots. But in this moment, we definitely need to be, I think, a bit more discerning in where we invest our time, our energy, and our budget.
What a note to end on. Dina, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Gen Z. You've been a highly sought after guest. So we appreciate you sharing your words.
It's been
of
a
wisdom.
Year. We've been asking.
I know. We made it happen. I'm so glad.
Right. Thank you to the comms team at Shiseido for approving Dina to come on.
Thank you, everyone.
Avery, always love when we have great interviews. Dina is such a big thinker in the space. I know we both have had lovely amounts of time with her. What did you think of?
Dina's so articulate. I feel like we learned a lot of new vocabulary words. We heard a lot of vocabulary words in her interview that are way above average. So I thought she did an amazing job and had so many insights to share. And the thing that I want to almost double down on is her conviction in digital collectibles and blockchain technology. Because I think in an era where a lot of people are like, my job is no longer at Web3 and Metaverse, I'm head of innovation now. Dina's like, no, I believe in this. I believe in the future here. And I think that came through really clearly in the interview. That was my take. What was your take?
One, I agree. She's so well-spoken. It always makes me feel really stupid because she just like, I was an English major, yet she's the one.
So was I.
I also, look at that, of course. It's so funny because I've also been saying to Dina, I think since 2018 that she needs to have a podcast, and she's done with like 7 or 8 different ideas and she never does it. Because I'm also like, I really like the tone of her voice. So that's just my own like weird thing where I just like hearing her talk. But she was on the panel that I moderated in South by at the Boys Club event, and she is just so good at it. And I also think brings like a great sense of conviction, mm-hmm. as you mentioned, which I think is really important, and reason into the space. She has done so many things early in her career as someone who really boldly pushes the brands she works with to take risk. And I think often it's paid off, like we heard about with Roblox. So I was like really, really impressed with
Absolutely.
That. But I think, we've been getting some great folks on. So just like another one in the belt of just people who are expanding our minds and the industry. And we just love charting what they're doing.
We have had a really good run of guests recently. And I love the sort of evolution of where we're going, because we're still talking a lot about blockchain. We're still talking a lot about crypto, about virtual world. Virtual influencers is the thing that is very top of my mind. You know this. So Gen Z, stay tuned.
We are working on getting that conversation going on the virtual influencer side. So for sure, we'll make it happen. But Avery, you and I are extremely real and we have places to go. So with that, Gen Z, thank you for listening.
We'll see you next time, Gen Z.